The True Wealth, your tangible assets advisor. This is Kevin Walter, your host. True Wealth is brought to you by Coins Plus in Spokane, Washington. Coins Plus is your full-service rare coin and precious metals broker, dealer, depository service. Remember, we've been serving the area and in a honesty, integrity, and professionalistic way since the mid-90s. And I think, you know, we've established a good reputation. We have a nice facility. We honor, respect, and appreciate our customers and all of you who listen to the show. And I just appreciate it. And, you know, we're human. We've been in, we've been out, we've been up, we've been down. It's been a number of years I've been on the air too. And it's, you know, I've learned some things. Like we went through a year a while ago where I probably maxed out the epitome of sleep deprivation. I had these friends have friends that are in the special forces, and I thought, well, heck, if they can do it, I can do it. Well, guess what? Real good for you. Comes at a toll, too. So we've learned a lot of lessons here, and we've, you know, over the years in our business, we've become less focused on, well, we never were, but I mean, income, profit's not our real goal. Helping you out is our goal. We're very wholesale. We're incredibly fair. If you knew the business, like I knew the business, know the business, you'd realize when you do business with us, you're getting taken incredibly good care of. You're getting sold products at exactly what they're worth. So when the market moves, you're automatically making money. And you know, if you don't know that, and, you know, even if you think you're out shopping the web and teaching yourself for, you know, people tend to become one-minute experts, I call it. You know, they look around. They don't realize that everything's advertising, and they fall, and they'll say, oh, I want American Silver Eagles, and these guys have the best pricing, and then they'll, you know, they have commissioned salespeople. They'll start pushing you into something else, which, or additionally, and you think, well, they, you know, their price was good on the Eagles, so they must be fair on this, and they're not. They're very high. You know, there's all kinds of things. There's all kinds of things with, you know, shipping and handling and games that get played with spot prices and locking in and all kinds of stuff, right? And so you just, in a simplistic manner, what I'm saying is at Coins Plus, we're always going to treat you fair. We're always going to treat you right. We believe very much in God and the Bible. People, I say to people, you know, I just don't have a desire to take advantage of people. And people always say, well, you can't, it'll ruin your business, you know, or, you know, it'll catch up to you. And I'm like, you know, that is not my motivation. I am not motivated by what I can't get away with. I think as believers, we have to have our hearts in a place that does what's right no matter, you know, the outcome or potential consequences. You know, we've discussed that here recently on the show. You know, that's character. And it's one of the leadership qualities I've kind of been covering today. We can pick that back up in the beforehand. I'd like to wanted to touch on I've talked about the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. In fact, I've more than talked about it. I've recommended it to numerous people and to listeners over the years. Those who read it are really enlightened. It's a very, very good book. It's a necessary book. It's a top 10 have to read in your lifetime book, in my opinion. It's called The Creature from Jekyll Island. The name sounds spooky and ooey and awe, but actually, I don't know what else he'd call it, but it's the story of how the Federal Reserve came into play. And so I've just got some notes from a time ago. I'm going to kind of, let's see how many notes there are. Oh, there are quite a few. Well, let me just go through a little bit of this and we'll see where we end up. Maybe we'll do some leadership stuff, maybe not. So in November of 1910, there was seven, depending on, so we'll say seven very well-known and wealthy men left the northeastern United States on trains to do some duck hunting off an island off off of Brunswick, Georgia. The island was called Jekyll Island. So all these guys, now remember, these are the well-known and wealthy men. They had the four of the men that were involved, and I'll get into the names here in a minute, possessed half of the Earth's wealth. I mean, think about that. Four men possessed half of the Earth's wealth. That, my friends, is power. That is the kind of person who says, gosh, wouldn't it be neat if we could, you know, do this? They have no limitation on money, on funding, you know, on research, on people designing this new Reserve Act, Federal Reserve Act. And, you know, these, a lot can be done with a lot of money. I was, you know, reading about a local individual here recently in the Spokesman. It says he has they have now over 30,000 rental units, individual units. That's a family that's passed it on down. We said they have over $4 billion in discretionary income sitting in a bank. And then he's starting this company, which is patented and is beginning to use cross-laminated woods that are stronger than steel. And he has so far generated $386 million in investments and so on and so forth. You get the picture. Big bucks get big bucks. Big bucks beget big bucks. It takes money to make money, and it takes insane craziness, otherwise known sometimes as kahunas in the world, to get that big most of the time. But entrepreneurs that hit those levels, they don't know fear. They see, which is actually a good thing for all of us to keep in mind. There's different personalities, you or I or whatever. I am more entrepreneurial. I see the opportunities and the potentials. I also, because of my banking background, have the devil's advocate ability to hyperanalyze things and hypothetically, you know, predict problem areas, etc., or just to make good sound decisions on the fly. Other people become terrorized, mesmerized by potential, their potential failure. And it's really weird talking to people. You and I have done it. You know, there's people like, oh my gosh, I could never do that. You know, they just see what could go wrong. What about this? What about that? And they're very binary in their thinking, not expansive. And we talked last show about, you know, like your spiritual peripheral vision and, you know, your eyes of faith. And that's the thing. If we're in touch with God and his will and our destiny, man, no holds barred. You pray, God's on your side. He gave you the talents and the abilities. He's got a vested interest in your outcome too. And now since I'm on this sort of kind of a topic, I just kind of wanted to, you know, a kind of a little quick glory story here. And the moral of this story is that God honors those who honor him. And so there's a gentleman who's now a pastor of a very large church down in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And I've known him for a number of years, many years. And his father was a pastor of some churches, and he had one out on the coast. He had these pastor-led church models that they're very dysfunctional. There's not the appropriate level of spiritual accountability. The pastor becomes the, you know, is all, has all, does all, you know, everything king. And he had, this pastor, this gentleman's father, at one point, had sold it, the churches off or whatever, and ran off with a lot of money, a couple million plus. Real bad, right? And this kid, who's no longer a kid, grew up under these auspices as a spiritual family. Super loyal kid. Good, godly, neat, committed, just on fire. Picked up some of the dad's bad habits, obviously, in leadership, but he's a super strong leader. So the bottom line is he was called out to ministry in another area, and there was some struggles. Obviously, his dad was not supportive. And then it got more extreme to the point where his father, he blackballed him, essentially, excommunicated him from the church. And there was absolutely no sin involved, none of that, just just dysfunction, just control. And then the church began to fracture because anyone who was on his son's, or not even on his son's side, that just supported it or, you know, tried to see it both ways, the pastor of the church, you know, just basically, and this is another church, he'd obviously ran off with money one time and opened another church. Now this one's failing. But when anybody sided with his son or said, hey, you know, let's be logical, there was different deacons or he called them, I don't know, on his board in the church, he'd get advice supposedly from these guys. And anytime he didn't like the advice, he'd try to, you know, he'd try to change it. And that's another skill that people learn where they try to get you, you know, they want your advice to really, when you really want wisdom, obviously someone has to have a grasp and a control on what you're discussing so that their insight or counsel is appropriate and relevant and wise. But once they do, you got to take it. It doesn't mean you got to act on it, but you got to let it come at you the way it comes at you. And then you have to ask the Holy Spirit to guide you in processing it, because it's so clear that God made it that no king should ever make decisions without, you know, seeking counsel. And no man, we all need wise counsel, but boy, do we struggle with it. And there's people, there's so many different personalities. I've had personalities work for me where I'm like, I want you to, you know, share your ideas. Oh, you know, no. And I had one guy, well, you won't implement them. I said, you don't know that. I want your ideas. I said, I'll process them. I may use them. I may not, but you know, your input's more than welcome. And then I finally got him to start putting in a little bit, and I got to know him a little more. He had some struggles. And he'd give me advice, and then he'd get angry that I didn't use it. And I'm like, look, I want your advice, but it doesn't mean that I'm always going to use it. But he actually couldn't understand that if he took the time to give it to me, and he was working for me, and he was, you know, he'd never owned a business or anything. But it's just it's a thought process. So many people process things so differently. I think that's one of the things I'm really learning in life is the differences in humanity. And so, you know, so anyway, I'll go back. This son who was called out to go, the dad blackballed him, I don't know a better name, excommunicated, whatever the word is. And it got really bad, and a lot of lies and rumors and dishonest stories, and it just got really ugly. And this kid went down to where he was called at first, Arizona. And, you know, he just served. He had a great ministry and on. I'll try to keep it short. So over time, basically, he'd been completely and totally rejected by his father and for no good cause. I tried contacting the father, and it was an absolute disaster. It was I tried to approach him from a perspective of compassion and love as a father. You know, kind of the, you know, what father, when his son asks for a loaf of bread, will give him a rock or a snake, you know? It's like, why would we do that to our children? There's times that we have to withhold things and love for discipline and just to do what's right, but this was not the case. And so this kid, he was in his 20s, he's in his 30s now. He honored his dad through all this. He and I talked a lot, and he honored him. Even though his dad was behaving in horrible ways, saying things behind his back, and as things went on, the kid had, and I'm saying this because I don't want names out there, but, you know, he'd had what were ultimately grandchildren for his father, the pastor, and it was just nothing. It was really mishandled. So the long and short of it is, it's been probably 10, 11 years. I've watched this kid, you know, honor God in all ways. Really a good person, totally human, got flaws, but he honors God. God comes first. He's righteous, which means right-minded towards Christ. Doesn't mean perfect, but he's just a good, he loves God. That's who he serves. And he's had great success. And his ministry's grown to phenomenal levels. There's other stories I could get into, but I won't. And now he's in a position where, you know, a couple years back, he was being really driven to open a church, and, you know, he was looking at certain things, and we talked and prayed, and he held off, and a major church group came, and you know, basically discovered him and picked up, you know, a great training program and everything. And so he's got this wonderful church now. He's, you know, in his 30s, and he's currently working on a large transaction building and at a incredibly ridiculously low price that God's preserved for him. Obviously, he's been told about it from God for a couple years and whatnot. But it just, I just wanted to, it's hard to say it without getting too specific. But he is, I mean, he's being exalted and he is lifting God up. He's got 700 people now in his congregation. It's unbelievable. And it's all, I was talking to him last night, he's just honored God nonstop. From the start. And he honored God by honoring his parents. You know, the Bible, the command, I think, is it the fourth commandment? I may, you know, who knows? It's, you know, honor your mother and father, that you basically, condensed paraphrase, honor your father and mother that you may live a long, healthy, happy life. So your honoring your parents is not dependent upon their honoring you. That is so important with respect in every way. I don't, it applies to you as an employee. It applies to you as a spouse, et cetera. Honor and respect are always there. You don't need emotion to jump in. You need to just act right and do right, not overreact to things, you know, and just be solid and stable. We learn so many crazy habits, and we have grudges, and we get even, and we, you know, all these things. God says, don't seek revenge. Vengeance is mine. When it comes to your parents, that is the foundation. Think about it. You know how they say the nuclear family is the foundation of society. Amen. Praise God. It's true, but it is getting totally blown apart in our society. How many families have actual sit down dinner with the kids? I'd say very few. Percentage-wise, kids are in sports. You know, when do sports run? Right through dinner time, soccer. You know, I remember kids will have soccer games, you know, Saturday morning at 7 a.m. and then another one Saturday afternoon at 5. And then one's on Thursday night at 7:15. You know, it just eats your schedule up. And a lot of people feel all this pressure. Oh, sports are good for the kids. They're super good for the kids. But it's super hard on the parents. So don't put yourself, you know, too far in that arena. As a parent, you don't want to stretch yourself out too thin that way. It can be a bit much. But the the moral of the story is the significance of the nuclear family. The significance of the family is the foundation of a society and the foundation of a nation, and ultimately the world. And as this falls apart, folks, you see the castle crumbling all around us, right? I mean, we've got people running on socialism. We've got this terrible impeachment farce going on against Trump, which is sick, sad. I mean, it's super sad, folks. I mean, it is just sad. Trump's bummed out, I can tell. The guy's played by his own rules, right? But this is like way over the top, dirty, dirty, mean, vengeful, hateful. You've got Hillary just filled with vile vitriol and negativity, and everybody's an agent of Russia. I don't know if you watch this stuff, but, you know, it's just such a breakdown. How many of us would ever let our children behave even a fraction of the way that our politicians behave? None. And so much of it has to do with who we are, who we've become, what our expectations. I mean, how do you get these outspoken, rebellious youngsters, you know, that are protesting unreasonably and irrationally and destroying things? And it's the breakdown of the family. I remember years back studying, when I was studying psychiatry or psychology, and they talked about the number one act of a boy, maybe a child, but a boy without a father. Not that the father doesn't exist, but a father who's not present. The first is forms of vandalism. They'll trash things. They'll, you know, then you see these gangsters go out and they start tagging stuff, right? And then it's theft. And then from there, if it continues, it's a violation of human rights. It's a disrespect for people's personal space and safety and security. Don't ask me why. It's proven. You're a father. You better get to know your kid. If your kid's going off the rails, you got to get together with your wife, get it straightened up. I can't tell you the number of people I've seen go through that, been through it myself a little bit. It's just, you got to get on the same page with your spouse. So I know I go off on tangents. That stuff's on my heart. So we, oh, nice here. Okay. So let's get rolling on this thing. Jekyll Island. So they carried all their, these guys, these seven guys, four of the richest in the world, they're carrying all their duck hunting gear in plain sight so that any inquisitive reporter could see that they were going duck hunting. So when they arrived at Jekyll Island, the duck hunters moved into a posh resort known by J.P. Morgan, or owned by J.P. Morgan on Jekyll Island. And if you don't know, J.P. Morgan he was the richest man in the world. He's passed, but his company is amazing, and we'll cover that in a minute here. In latter years, at least one of these men admitted that he never shot a duck and never intended to. Another of the men later punned that duck hunting was a blind for what they were doing. So these seven extremely wealthy men were surrogates of our national government and powerful financiers. So they were acting on behalf of the government. The financiers were seeming competitors with one another, which gives you more insight. When people get up to that high level, they collude. They have no reason not to. They're already at the top of their game, and in order to get, they just collude. Let's be real. So these guys are supposed to competitors, but they are setting up the world's biggest, most profitable bank corporation that now that we know of now makes $130 billion a year is what the Fed made. That's not too shabby. That means about every 7.5 years they make $1 trillion. I wouldn't mind being on that payroll. And so they were competitors with one another and subordinate to and regulated by the government. And so the surrogates of the government, they were not at Jekyll Island to sharpen their business relationships. They were there to agree on unconstitutional collusions between private corporations and government. So they're setting up big collusion, which would restrict their lesser competitors and allow them to create debt-based money that was going to be secured by nothing but thin air. I mean, they actually knew this. So from which they and their cronies could get rich by endless multiplication of debt-created money and the financial treason, as I discussed in one of the previous shows, they called fractional reserve banking. They were there to covertly bring the deceits, corruptions, frauds of the centuries-old European central banking to the United States. This is the Rothschilds thing. And our forefathers who originally penned our U.S. monetary system from ever entering this country, as they had already seen the corruption and destruction it had created in Europe, from which they fled. So they've already seen this happen. So this type of monetary system, fiat currency, Keynesian economics, is specifically designed to elevate the few elitists at the expense of the citizens, corporations, politicians, and bankers. So we'll get rolling on this. So there's the seven key players. I'm not sure that their names are all that important, but there's, you know, J.P. Morgan, Nelson Aldrich. J.P. Morgan really, you know, he'd done it all. He created the Dow Jones. He created the New York Stock Exchange. He was a huge steel baron. I mean, the guy was just king of kings, right? He was kind of the kingpin of the whole thing. So you had these other guys, Harry Davison, Charles Norton, Benjamin Strong, these guys, you just don't know who they are. Paul Warburg. Warburg's a big name, that he was representing Rothschilds and Warburgs in Europe. And anyway, so keep in mind with J.P. Morgan that Wall Street and the Federal Reserve were both, and the New York Stock Exchange, were both or all the creations of J.P. Morgan. So he was a power player. He was banker and financier. In other words, you know, the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules. The more money you have, the more money you make. You know how that works. They were creating a system that was, it was unbreakable. Basically, once they got this system going, it would lock down on our system and we'd never get out of it. It would ultimately push us into socialism, into this new world order that started so long ago. And you remember George Bush Sr. was always talking of the new world order, and it freaked people out because it was. It's interesting. You take these things that are so taboo and you speak them outright and people become numb to them. And the next thing you know, it's accessible, just like it's acceptable, just like socialism is with AOC and all the hate and racism and threats and everything. So with J.P. Morgan, so he had Wall Street and the Federal Reserve. So the combination of these two financial entities has been the driving forces behind the ever-accelerating and eventual economic destruction of this nation. Now, you might think, you know, that's foolish. We're great. We're a very rich, wealthy, healthy nation. You're right. We've had great initiative and innovation, and the American worker is unlike any in history. We keep producing. They keep taking. But guess what happens? We produce and we accumulate, but as we accumulate now, we're accumulating this thing called debt and tons of it. And to find people that don't have it anymore is really rare. When the Fed started, nobody had debt. Homes were average home sales price across America was $700. Now we're up to $300,000. That's what debt's done to us. So in a nation's financial condition, so anyway, you've got the Federal Reserve and Wall Street working together now where they can pump money and really keep this thing propped up. J.P. Morgan's like in the box. So when you combine these two, they're the driving forces that have accelerated us, as I've said, towards ultimate economic, destruction, I guess. I hate to use the word, but... So a nation's financial condition, whether weak or strong, is the very root of that nation's status among other nations. And you got to think about that. Our wealth equates to our power, equates to our success. Like I said, unfortunately, Solomon said money is the answer to everything. They say money is not everything, but a lack of it sure sucks. And when you're big like this, you know, they can do crazy things. Bad things happen. You get the George Soros thing going on. They can literally turn the tide of the world. That's where politics gets a little bit extreme, too. But, W.A. Clark, one of the big copper barons who made money when electricity came in, said, "I've never met a man who can't be bought." And he would find everybody's hot button. And you wouldn't even know you're being bought. He'd just find something you liked and take care of you in his own way, right? So a nation's financial condition is their signature status among other nations. If their financial condition is strong, they rule over the nations. If their financial condition's weak, other nations rule over them, right? So this fact remains true with every great empire that's ruled this planet since the beginning of human history. To destroy the financial strength of a great nation like the U.S. of A. is to destroy their reign as a superpower on Earth. Not an accident, right? So J.P. Morgan not only designed a system to control and eventually destroy this nation's strength, but he also created a system to increase his wealth and the wealth of those he chose to pass this power on to. So J.P. Morgan Bank is the one mega bank in the U.S. and the world one of the few that came out of the big financial debacle back in 2008, far more liquid and far more wealthy than any other bank on earth. I wonder how they got set up that way. Remember, J.P. Morgan, Federal Reserve, J.P. Morgan Bank, Federal Reserve, bailouts, they come out the richest, most liquid bank on earth. That's when you know you got your hand in the kitty. There's a lot of money to go around there. So J.P. Morgan and also Goldman Sachs, they call government Sachs, but that's another conversation for another day, as I say. So Wall Street and the Federal Reserve were designed to favor J.P. Morgan with every turn and every decision. With every financial crisis which has occurred since the creation of the Fed, the J.P. Morgan Corporation's rise to financial power has continued, and they've grown stronger and more solvent than before every crisis. In other words, through every crisis, every Federal Reserve-based bailout, J.P. Morgan Bank has either received the money or has been the conduit of the money. 21 bailouts. They've all gone through J.P. Morgan Bank. That makes you... should make you pause for a second and think about that. So J.P. Morgan and Joseph Kennedy, and you know who he is, that's the grandfather of Kennedy's. That's the one who, he by being buddies with J.P. Morgan, he got very wealthy. That's how the Kennedys got their money, through the Federal Reserve. So J.P. Morgan, Joseph Kennedy, and friends had the mysterious foresight to sell all of their stock holdings and buy gold within days prior to the great stock market crash of 29. There's like a handful of good friends, more than a handful, that all sold out and sold a lot and got out of the stock market just in the nick of time, grabbed gold. The market crashes, their gold, you know, stays solid, and pretty soon everybody loses their wealth, but those with gold and silver, they're, not only do you maintain your wealth, you're gaining wealth. There's two ways you gain it. One is it goes up. But what's most important is, like they say, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. Okay? So in the land of the broke, he who has gold becomes king. God says that the wicked store up for the righteous. I believe that day is coming, and I believe that a lot is being stored up for the righteous. That hopefully is you and me, and that's the way God operates. But it's essentially important to understand precious metals never go away. They never get – well, okay. They can get lost or stolen, but other than that, you can't lose on them. I mean, they're always going to be there. They're never going to be worthless. People say, hey, well, how do I know when it's this? I remember when people say, well, if it ever gets to 1,000 an ounce, who would ever buy it for that much? And I was always like, well, it's supply and demand. If the price is up, it's because people are buying it. And I'd have people say, well, I just can't even imagine. There's no way anybody'd buy it that high. Well, it wouldn't be that high if people weren't buying it, number one. And number two, it's small thinking, you know. It's small thinking, and it's like Donald Trump said to his kids, if you're going to be thinking anyway, you might as well think big. And I think that has a lot to do with our mindset. there was a story I heard a friend telling, and he was in church, and he kept feeling this urge. All he had on him was $5. And he kept feeling this urge to give this $5 to this girl with a kid. And he kept feeling God say, give her $5. Give her all you got, $5. He's like, Lord, I can't give her $5. I'll be embarrassed. That's too little. And God said, do it, you know. And so the guy said he contended with God. And about 20 minutes from the end of the service, he just did. He just got up, walked over and says, I feel like I'm supposed to give you this. I don't know why. I wish I could give you more. Sorry. Well, afterwards, he talked to the girl. She wept, and she'd never gone to church before. It was her first time, and she'd been invited or whatever, and the person wasn't there. It doesn't matter, but she'd never been, but she decided this day to go, and she took her son with her. She was poor, and she barely had enough gas to get there, and when she got there, she basically ran out of gas, and her prayer was, Lord, you know, I'll go to church. If you're real, you'll give me enough gas money to get home. Well, that's what this $5 was for. So God answered a prayer in a very specific way. There's a ton of meaning there because it's a small amount of money, but it's a very specific amount of money. It's enough to say God's there. He's real. He saw. He knows. But like I said to this guy, I said, you know what's interesting that goes through my mind? I said, you know, that gal was just beginning her walk with God, and she prayed for just enough gas to get home. Well, how big is our God? When you get to know our God, you don't pray for $5 in gas. You pray for maybe a gas tank or a barrel of gas or Shell, unlimited Shell oil car, whatever, I don't know. But the point is, our God's huge. Our God is as big as we allow him to be. We limit God so much with our mind. Our mind is both. Our mind, we can expand mentally to the edges of the universe. We can come up with incredible ideas, wonderful things. Or we can stifle ourselves and be negative and shoot ourselves down or run other people down, you know, with our mind. And no one will ever amount to this or that. And we can limit ourselves mentally, and especially when we pray. Pray big. Pray real. Delight yourself in the Lord. He'll give you the desires of your heart. That is what Psalms 37 says. So I was just talking about these rich boys that had coincidentally had a perfect timing pulling their money out of the stock market right before the big crash of 29 and putting it in gold. My point being, when you have metals, folks, you got nothing to worry about. Now, I know real estate and all that, yeah, that can go down, and it, you know, it can, people can repossess it. There's all kinds of things, and you owe taxes endlessly, and, you know, it's good to have. I play with it, but man, what a bureaucratic nightmare real estate is. So gold works in the long run. So you got Joseph Kennedy, his close friend, confidant, and business partner of J.P. Morgan. And he said that he claimed that he knew the rampant stock speculation of the late 20s would lead to a crash. And it said that he knew it was time to get out of the market when he started to receive stock tips from a shoeshine boy. Okay? You know, that's like they say, when single mothers on welfare are giving you stock advice, it's time to get out, right? And so, in addition to this ironically coincidental reaction that made them into today's equivalent of overnight billionaires by eventually using the gold they'd obtained to purchase nearly everything of value, including real estate, at literally at pennies on the dollar, just 4 years after the crash and as the Great Depression got underway. So converting their paper into gold made them very wealthy. And then they were able to go out and buy real estate for pennies on the dollar. They were, I mean, the market crashed. It was beautiful, like it is now, as Trump would say. It's very beautiful. It's huge. It's tremendous. It's fantastic. Well, it's also not real. Things don't last like this. This is not, we're not booming. We're not kicking tail. There's a lot going up in real estate, but there's a lot of other areas sucking up. I started on this today because I was reading, you know, they're saying that our budget deficit's over $1 trillion and, you know, up 26%. And people don't even know what that means, you know, and it's talking over a specific period of time, like a quarter of the year, and they're, you know, they just confuse people. The bottom line is our budget deficit just keeps getting higher and higher and higher and more and more and more because our budget, well, it's not a budget, our expenditures won't stop. Obama was the first president to not budget, to just say, heck with it, I don't want to see it. You, Congress, you write the budget. If someone wants the money, we give it to them. The only people that they fought, Obama and his henchmen, were conservative Christians. We saw what they did with 501c3 license rejection and all kinds of that. But they were not, other than that, they had no desire to control the finances of this country in any way. The Cloward and Piven strategy, Saul Alinsky, whatever you want to say, they are committed to destroy America. One thing I've heard a lot lately about these politicians running for office is people with guts say they, not say they themselves, they say this demo socialistic communistic whatever party that is out there now against Trump, they are absolutely so committed to hardcore socialism and the destruction of this nation. They literally don't like the nation. They'll say they do, but what they mean is they like their view and vision of a nation that you and I can't even comprehend. So I just think we need to call a spade a spade. Things are getting so dirty, so hard, so fast. You cannot, do not choke on your words anymore. Just polish them up. If you know what you want to say to people, think before you say it and smooth it up. But you got to speak up because the resistance never quits. And as we've said, all that's necessary for evil to prevail is good men or women to do nothing. Okay? People that know the truth. Don't sit. Do, for sure. Important, right? So, you've got Kennedy here. He says he knew that the big crash was coming. And that's when, you know, they essentially got, 4 years later, they bought up Manhattan and everything else. You go downtown Manhattan and you can see the Rockefeller Center. I mean, they just had consumed everything. Those are the bankers of the world in a big, bad way, you know. So they became overnight billionaires. This is the whole design of the system. So J.P. Morgan had also placed himself in a precarious position as banker and director of Wall Street. He made rules governing Wall Street that stated that companies must confidentially, think about this, confidentially provide accurate monthly profit and loss financial statements to who? Mr. J.P. Morgan himself. In addition to this, Mr. Morgan was in the corporate money lending game, so he knew who needed money, when and why they needed money, and when they were able to make payments on the money he had loaned them. There was no SEC as we know it today. That's Securities and Exchange Commission. There was no oversight board as we know it today, and J.P. Morgan allowed himself to engage in the epitome of insider trading by buying and selling stocks to companies which he was intimately financially tied to. Not every dollar was made the old-fashioned way, as they say. According to the golden rule of the world, as I said, he who has the gold makes the rules. And that, my friends, is what J.P. Morgan himself did. So impending changes within the U.S. banking and monetary system were making it imperative that the super-rich class race elitists desperately needed an immediate and extraordinary mechanism to permanently secure control of our monetary system for the world's fastest-growing superpower who operated under the auspices of the U.S. Constitution. Citizens of nine states had already passed laws into their state constitution to drive off decades-old corruptions that held vast profits and power for the class race elitists, in other words, banks. The corrupt, super-rich bankers were losing their power and control in the U.S., okay? That's what made them do this as a last-ditch effort to drive the claws in so they could never be pulled out. So in 1910, and the Federal Reserve Act came in 1913, in 1910, these class race elitists, they really are there. That's when eugenics was around and they believed in superior genetics, and you know, they were the class race elitists. They'd been able to use their power and influence to buy time by pushing countless states' rights legislation contests through the U.S. Supreme Court, who instantly, arbitrarily, and unconstitutionally froze all states' rights to pass legislation pertaining to their constitutions, which froze their power to protect themselves against any and all state constitutional violations. That may not make sense to you, but I'll get to it. These actions were put into place by the firm of Paul Warburg, who worked for John D. Rockefeller. So now you understand, they're putting the handcuffs on the states that are trying to fight this. So any judges, ahead of time, they're planning ahead, any judges who attempted to uphold their state's constitutions during this time would be immediately impeached and removed from office within days or sometimes even hours. These delays in the states' abilities to exercise their constitutional right to protect themselves is what allowed the presidentially signed Federal Reserve Act to apply to all states in existence at that time. The Federal Reserve Act was an unconstitutional executive order put into place by President Woodrow Wilson, and that was at an emergency meeting of 11 members of Congress on December 24th, Christmas Eve, of 1913. And it was also Friday the 13th. No, I'm kidding. It was 1913. That's a number that may have meaning. President Woodrow Wilson was an extreme liberal, a radical socialist. See, socialism was this great new ideology that was taken off. It had never been used. That's why it went into full favor globally. And tyrants and dictators and, you know, the death of over 100 million citizens had not yet occurred, but was coming. And now we're at a point where we've experienced that, and a couple generations are moving on, and they're getting amnesia, historical amnesia. So we had Paul Warburg, who was putting in all these laws, putting the clamps on judges and the state constitutions. And they didn't know why or what was going on. They were preparing to jam this law through. So, like I said, they got these judges out of there right away. The laws of elitists, money, and power had trumped the laws of nations for thousands of years. In other words, money makes the world go round, right? No matter what the laws are, you got enough money, you get what you want. Except for Epstein, the guy who is, sex trade and all that, billionaire. The Jekyll Island Duck Hunting Society was unfortunately amazingly successful for all the wrong reasons and at huge expense of each and every ordinary citizen, American citizen. The Jekyll Island Good Old Boys Club saw their labors put into the stone of federal statute when a fearful, impressionable, and compliant President Woodrow Wilson signed the Federal Reserve Act on the 24th of December, 1913. Woodrow Wilson was very intelligent and completely aware. I got that wrong. It was December 23rd. It was the night before Christmas Eve. On the night before Christmas, when all through the house, nobody had any cash except for seven men. Merry Christmas. Woodrow Wilson was very intelligent and completely aware that his signature was creating an unconstitutional anti-law regime. Think of this. President of the United States of America signing over a private act, an executive order that overrode the constitutional mandate that Congress shall control all aspects of monetary creation and regulation, and anyone who gets in the way shall be put to death, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. this was the beginning of a new general. This is the beginning of the slide we're on right now, folks. I'll just say that. So Woodrow Wilson was very intelligent and completely aware of what he was doing, right? He knew it was unconstitutional, and it was an anti-law regime, null and void from its very inception, basically. And it was enforced under dozens of felony violations of a broad spectrum of federal laws and statutes. Today, nearly 100 years later or more, the felony violations continue to stack up daily beyond imagination, every second of every day. So Wilson and his powerful predators of Congress, so we're talking about the creature from Jekyll Island, the creation of the Federal Reserve, if you didn't know, I kind of got into this. So Wilson and his powerful predators of Congress knowingly and intentionally usurped Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, and that's the one I just read, which states, I keep getting ahead of myself, I have it written here, but I say it too soon. So it says, the Congress shall have the power, in paragraph 5, to coin money, regulate the value thereof, and of foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measures. With the 1913 Federal Reserve Act, Congress and the President unconstitutionally delegated Congress's specifically assigned duty that they were to coin debt-free money secured by precious metals alone. That was our gold standard. That was the world standard. That was us. They delegated that duty to a privately owned corporation whose expressed intent was to print debt-based money. I mean, think of it. I have a banker's brain, boys and girls. I can't even comprehend what Woodrow Wilson did. Glenn Beck used to really rail on him, and the left used to get mad, but I'm telling you what, Glenn was right. Fiat money secured only by thin air was what these guys had created. If you think about it, these rich guys got together and said, hey, what if, we got all the money, let's buy off the people we need to, let's get other people involved we need to, and let's create a system where we make monopoly money, and only we have a right to control it. So we make monopoly money backed by debt. Everyone owes us the money plus the debt as a debt with interest. And then we end up backing all the banks. We end up accumulating all the collateral, repossessions, and whatnot. It's the biggest sham ever. And we're the toughest nation in the history of the world to be able to endure this for so long. it's been really phenomenal how strong and resilient the American public is. And don't be fooled. This system's not okay. There's no confusion. There's no two sides. It is what it is. There's fools that'll tell you, oh, you know, they'll give you, well, we outgrow. The trick is to outgrow this and that. You can't outgrow everything forever. And you don't want to be in a position where you have to. That's called lots of pressure. That's called like being a big corporation with tons of debt. And you got to do more and more and more business just to try to pay the debt. It doesn't, it loses its fun. So, you know, you get what I'm saying. So, okay. So they delegated, well, with the 1913 Federal Reserve Act, Congress and the president, you know, they unconstitutionally gave up all their duties or all their responsibilities. They delegated it to the Federal Reserve, a private bank. It's important that you understand that. That now this private corporation's making our money out of thin air, and many other expressed intents were the interests of private financial corporations, not in the interests of civil society or constitutional governance. So there's nothing in the Constitution that allows the giveaway or delegation of any expressed duty or power to any other branch or institution, especially a private institution. There's nothing like that in the Constitution. The Federal Reserve Act was unconstitutional, felonious, and treasonous from its first moment of existence. And it's exactly the same today. We have so many things that we accept as second nature. You know, our income tax, that's called a direct tax. Our founding fathers said no. They put that in. They called it slavery. They hated it. They'd been through it forever. They created this incredible country where taxes were based on production and consumption, export, import, you know, of business. And you then you'd pay tax, or you can do a consumption tax, a national sales tax, but not income tax. But it's income tax is a socialistic propaganda or one of the 10 planks of communism under Karl Marx. A progressive income tax is that's a socialist act. We put all this into place. We're enduring. We're hanging. But how long? Look at the immorality breakdown. Look at our financial breakdown. Look at the debt. $1.5 trillion in student loan debt. Big article came out yesterday, a big study on college. Doesn't matter, you know. But they said people with 3.5 years of college don't get a very good job. If they put the other half year in and get their degree, they get a better job. So they're saying it's not the skills you gain in college that people want to hire. It's just the fact that you have a degree. And in America, you get all this liberal arts and all this other stuff. And they rack up debt like crazy. Credit card debt, $1.5 trillion. Automotive debt, $1.5 trillion. Those are all unsecured, essentially. I know you might think cars aren't, but if you've ever repossessed one after someone drove it into a mud river or something, you might understand. It's a depreciating liability is the bottom line. So the Constitution never allowed for this to be given away, as was the point of the states which were attempting to protect the constitutional rights of their citizens. The Federal Reserve Act is a federal statute that overturns the constitutional rights of citizens at the national level. This centuries-old trick, almost millennia-old, of these super bigoted class race elitists and their predator politicians is purely unacceptable. In today's mega corruption, which we know about, this old trick is a growing enterprise. People get involved with government where there's big money. They find ways to draw money out, enhance their own personal wealth, etc. So the two-party, three-branch system has made it a chief tenet of their political science. So we have a two-party system and a three-branch. So our politicians have figured out how to throw this at us hard and use it to their benefit. So in the weeks that led up to Woodrow Wilson signing the Federal Reserve Act in 1913, citizens of 8 more states attempted to put laws into their state constitutions to prevent this act from taking place. So a total now of 19 states had attempted to enact legislation preventing private monetization to affect their state's commerce systems. I mean, can you imagine that? 19 states were freaking out about this. These guys were doing something so corrupt, they'd never get away with it now. In 1913, the class race elitists had gone crazy out of fear fear of their efforts being overturned by states' democratic processes. The states had caught wind of what would soon take place, but it didn't understand the immediacy and urgency of the issue at hand. They didn't realize once it passed, that was it. It was done. And as they say, as I said earlier, all that's necessary for evil to prevail is for good men to do nothing. So just as we're facing, I think an unprecedented level of impending economic disaster in our future, that's just what I see from my analytical background. We relax in our creature comforts of today without preparing and protecting for tomorrow. So this coming economic disaster will come like a thief in the night, and very likely will not give anyone the opportunity to move until the damage has been done and there's nowhere to go. And that's typical anyway. And right now, it's really hard to know where to go with your money, too. That's why people are pouring into real estate, because it doesn't make any difference. Their money's not going to make them any money anywhere else, etc. So, you know, it's all by design. So it's like I said, I think it'll come like a thief in the night. But, you know, the key there is you won't have the opportunity to move until the damage is done. Frauds end suddenly. They don't come down like a big 747 for a smooth landing where you can see it coming. It's up and then it's down. And when it goes down hard and fast, and you're out of money. And a side note here, obviously, you should have a significant portion of your wealth secured in hard assets, gold, silver, and things of that nature. We can do that for you. Super thin margins. We've done incredible volume over the years. We're very professional. We have a good reputation, etc. It's just what you need to do biblically and even non-biblically, just from a perspective of wisdom. So just as we're facing this economic disaster, in my opinion, and it'll come like a thief in the night and not give anyone the opportunity to move. So many of us are procrastinators who just want to slide along, moving a little here and a little there, and then waiting until everything is clear before we make the move of a wise steward. We are living in very biblical times right now. So much activity around us is parallel to the things we've learned about in spiritual studies in the Bible. A wise steward will follow sound, conservative financial principles. And as the financial blitzkrieg crests over the horizon, and believe me, it will, we still have time to preserve our entire God-given capital. That's your and my God-given capital, what God's given us, wealth. The biblically endorsed and authorized precious metals are really what we're talking about here. And that's, I call that true wealth, obviously. And they're irrefutable throughout the test of time. This is the whole point. This is why they broke away from it. You have power when you have gold. They can't take it away. Nobody knows you have it. Nobody knows where you have it. It's not marked. It's not logged. It's not controllable. They can't tax it and destroy it and depreciate it and all these other things. It really is good to have. It's very good to have. There's no need for fear or worry. And real money is what we need at all times. But you just need to be secured well. Chinese, Middle Eastern, Indian, I've talked to them all. That's their culture. Gold is their financial foundation. And after they build that up, then they can go play and do whatever they want. And if they're successful, they can have fun because they've already got everything secured and protected. A lot in China, there's a lot of underground vaults under a lot of these houses. I have a friend who goes over there and sells to a lot of them, and he said it's unbelievable because they do multi-generational properties, and he said they have underground almost like museums of all their wealth. It's really amazing. So they have no need to fear financially anything. So I'll just end the show. I'll say, you know, don't wait to do the right thing or make the move. If you have any investments other than precious metals and anything it could be jeopardized, and you have, you know, anything at all left right now, or you probably have a nice nest egg. And we've been quite fortunate with the market doing what it is. So I just say, take that money, move it into God's money now while there's still time. And that's what this is all about. And sorry, I kind of chopped around. I was reading some notes I wrote a long time ago, and it was, it was not always that easy. But I appreciate you tuning in. I think you get the point. The history of the Fed, that is the very beginning of a very long long, tough road for America, you know, and globally. I mean, we're living in incredible biblical times. We're going to see some wild stuff in our lifetime. So, well, thank you again for tuning in. Take care. God bless. Get us some good reviews. Google, Yahoo, Yelp. Call us, two nice silver dollars. Help, let us help you invest. Take care. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye. God bless.